Chapter 3, The Dining Table, Act 1. In a brightly lit house with spacious rooms, a pleasant-looking man is busy in the kitchen. He is preparing a meal for his long-awaited guest. While hovering over the pots and pans, he reminds himself of the delicacies his guest is so fond of. His joyous anticipation is very evident. With the moves of a dancer, he fills the table with 5 different courses. Next to the table, there are 2 cushioned chairs. A knock on the door. The guest enters. The host's face brightens at the sight of the guest, and he invites him to sit at the dining table. The guest sits down, and the host looks at him fondly. The guest looks at the delicacies in front of him, sniffs them from a courteous distance. It is apparent that the guest likes what he sees, but expresses his admiration with a tactful restraint, not letting on that he knows the food is meant for him. Host. Do sit down. I've made these especially for you because I know how much you like these particular delights. We both know how familiar I am with your tastes and dining habits. I know you're hungry, and I know how much you can eat, so I've prepared everything exactly the way you like it, exactly to the amount that you can eat it all without leaving a crumb. Narrator. Now, if there were any food left when the guest is satiated, both host and guest would be unhappy. The host would be unhappy because that would mean that he wants to give his guest more than his guest wants to receive. The guest would be disappointed at not being able to fulfill the host's wish that he would consume the lot. The guest would also regret it if he were already full while there were still more delicacies left over, but had no room in his stomach to enjoy it. It would mean that there weren't a sufficient amount of desire for the pleasure. Guest. Indeed, you have prepared exactly what I'd like to see and eat at my dinner table. Even the amount is just right. This is all I could ever want of life, to enjoy this. If I were to have all that, then I would probably receive the ultimate divine pleasure. Host. Well, then have it all and enjoy it and thus delight me. The guest begins to eat. Guest. Obviously enjoying it with his mouth full, yet looks somewhat troubled. Why is it that the more I eat, the less I enjoy the food? The pleasure I get puts out the hunger, and I enjoy it less and less. The nearer I get to be full, the less I enjoy the meal. And when I've received all the food, I'm left with nothing but the memory of the pleasure, and not the pleasure itself. The pleasure was only there while I was hungry. When the hunger faded away, so did the joy. I've received what I so wished for, and here I am, left with neither pleasure nor joy. I don't want anything anymore, and have nothing to bring me joy. Host, a little resentful. I've done all I could for you to enjoy. It isn't my fault that the very receiving of pleasure extinguishes the sensation of delight because the yearning is gone. In any case, you're now full of what I've prepared for you. Guest, by receiving all that you've prepared for me, I can't even thank you because I've stopped enjoying the abundance that you've given me. The main thing is that I feel you have given me while I have given you nothing in return. So the outcome is that you've caused me to feel shame by thoughtlessly manifesting that you are the giver and I'm the taker. Host, I didn't show you that you're the receiver and I'm the giver, but the very fact that you've received something from me without return caused you to feel that you were receiving from me, despite the fact that kindness is my nature and I want nothing more than to have you accept my food. I can't change that. For example, I grow fish and they don't care who feeds and nourishes them. I also tend to Bob, my cat. He, too, couldn't care less whose was the hand that fed him. But Rex, my dog, does care, and he will not take food from just anyone. People are built in such a way that there are some who receive without sensing that someone is giving to them, and they just take. Some even steal with no remorse. But if a person has developed a sense of self, he feels the giver and is awakened in him the awareness that he's the taker. That brings with it the shame, self-reproach, and agony as a result. Guest. But what can I do to receive the pleasure on the one hand, and on the other, not perceive myself as the taker? How can I neutralize the feeling in me that you are the giver and I'm the taker? If there's a give-and-take situation, and it brings this shame in me, what can I do to avoid it? Or that perhaps you will act in such a way that I will not feel like the receiver? But then that's possible only if I'm unaware of your existence, like the fish, or if I sensed you, but I didn't understand that you were giving to me, like the cat, or an undeveloped human. Host, I think there is a solution after all. Perhaps you'll perform an act upon yourself that will neutralize the sensation of reception within you. Guest. Oh, I've got it. You've always wanted to have me as your guest. So tomorrow, I will come here and will perform the reception in such a way that will make you feel not as the giver, but as the receiver. I will still be the receiver, of course, eating all that you prepared, but I will perceive myself as the giver. Act 2. The next day, in the same room, the host has prepared a fresh meal with just the same delicacies as the day before. He sits at the table, and the guest enters, wearing an unfamiliar, somewhat secretive expression on his face. Host, smiling brightly, unaware of the change. I've been waiting for you. I'm so happy to see you. Do sit down. The guest sits at the table and politely smells the food. Guest. All this for me? Host. Of course, only for you. I would be so happy if you were willing to receive all that from me. Guest. I don't really want it all that much. Host. Well, that's not true. You do want it, and you know that for a fact. Why don't you have it? Guest. I can't take all that from you. It makes me feel uneasy. Host. What do you mean uneasy? I want so much for you to have all that. What do you think I've prepared this for? It would give me so much pleasure if you were to eat all that. Guest. Perhaps you're right, but I don't want to receive those dishes. Host. But in fact, you're not receiving a meal. You're doing me a favor by sitting at my table, enjoying what I've prepared. After all, I've prepared all that not for you, but because I so enjoy your reception for me. That's why your consent to eat would not be reception on your part. You'd be doing me a favor. You'd be receiving all that from me. On your part, it would not at all be taking, but rather giving me great joy. It turns out that it's not you who's receiving my meal, but rather me who's getting great joy out of you. You're the one giving to me, and not the other way around. The landlord imploringly slides the fragrant plate in front of his reluctant guest. The guest pushes it away. The landlord again slides it near to his guest, and again he is being turned down. The landlord sighs, and his whole appearance speaks of his desire that the guest should accept the food. The guest takes the posture of the giver who is doing the host a favor. Host, I implore you, make me happy. The guest starts to eat, then pauses to think. Then he starts again, and again he pauses. Each time the guest pauses, the host encourages him to continue. Only after some persuasion does the guest continue. The host keeps shoving new delicacies in front of his guest, each time begging him to please him by accepting them. Guest, if I can be sure that I'm eating because it gives you pleasure and not because I want it, then you've become the receiver and I've become the one giving you pleasure. But for that, I have to be sure that I'm eating for your sake alone and not for mine. Host, but of course you're eating only for me. After all, you sat at the table and you wouldn't taste a thing until I proved to you that you're not just eating but rather rendering me great joy. You've come to give me pleasure. Guest, but if I were to accept something I had no initial desire for, but that you had just offered me as something to accept, I would not enjoy the reception, and you wouldn't receive the joy of watching me be willing to accept your offering. It turns out that you can receive pleasure only to the extent that I enjoy your offering. Host, I know exactly how much you like this food, how much of each dish you can eat, and according to that, I've prepared 5 courses. After all, I know your desire for this and that dish and not for any other thing in your life. The knowledge of how much you enjoy it evokes the sensation of your pleasure in me. It creates a pleasure in me that you enjoy my dishes. I have no doubt that the pleasure I get out of you is well-founded. Guest, how can I be sure that I enjoy only because you want me to and because you've prepared all that for me? How can I be sure that I shouldn't turn you down, that by receiving from you I will actually be giving to you? Host, quite simple. Because you totally refuse my offers, and only after you were sure that you were doing it for me, you started to accept. After each bite you take, you feel you're doing it for me. You sense the joy you bring me. Guest, if I think, each time I receive, that I'm doing it for you, or else I would refuse to take it, by joining the intent to do it for you, along with the reception from you, I get rid of the shame and take pride in rendering you pleasure. Host, so eat it all. You want it all, and thus you'll be giving me every bit of pleasure you can. Guest, eating with pleasure and finishing every last dish, but then he's still not satisfied. So now I've eaten it all and enjoyed it. There's no more food to enjoy. My pleasure is gone because I'm not hungry anymore. I can't bring any of us joy right now. So what do I do next?
Host, I don't know.
You've given me comprehensive pleasure by receiving from me. What else can I do for you so that you'll enjoy again and again? How can you want to eat again if you've eaten it all? Where will you get a new appetite?
Guest,
true. My desire to enjoy has turned into a desire to bestow to you. And if now I can't enjoy, how can I bring you pleasure? After all, I can't create within me an appetite for another 5-course meal.
Host,
I have also not prepared any more than you desired for. I've done everything on my part. Your problem is, how can I stop wanting more as I receive more and more?
Guest,
but if the pleasure doesn't satisfy the hunger, it isn't felt as pleasure. The sensation of pleasure comes from the satisfaction of the need. If I weren't hungry, I couldn't enjoy the food, and hence could not have bestowed to you. What can I do to remain in constant want and constantly render you joy by receiving new pleasure?
Host,
For that, you need a different source of want and a different means for satisfaction. By using your hunger for the food and joy from it, you put them both out.
Guest,
I've got it. The problem is that I prevented myself from feeling joy if I felt you to be the benefactor. I refused to such an extent that the whole meal was laid down before me, yet I couldn't accept it because of the shame. That shame was so intense that I was willing to starve if only to avoid feeling the shame of being the recipient.
Host,
but then once you were convinced that you weren't receiving for yourself, you began to receive for my sake. Because of that, you enjoyed both the food and the pleasure you were rendering me. That's why the food should be in accordance with your will. After all, without pleasure from the food, what pleasure could you render to me?
Guest,
but it's not enough to receive for you, knowing that you enjoy me. If my pleasure comes from your joy, then the source of my pleasure is not the food, but you. I have to feel your joy.
Host,
I'm totally open about it.
Guest,
yes, but what does my pleasure depend on?
It depends on you, the one I'm giving pleasure to.
That means that my pleasure depends on the extent of my desire to bestow to you. That is, to the extent that I sense your greatness.
Host, so what can I do?
Guest, if I knew more of you, if I had a more intimate knowledge of you, if you really are great, then your greatness and almightiness would have been revealed to me. Then I would enjoy not only giving you pleasure, but also be aware of whom I was rendering pleasure to. Then my pleasure would have been proportional to the disclosing of your greatness.
Host, is it up to me?
Guest, look, if I give, it's important for me to know how much I'm giving and to whom. If it is to be beloved ones, for instance, my children, then to the extent of my love for them, I'm willing to give to them because by that, I myself enjoy. But if someone off the street comes to my house, I'm willing to give him something because I sympathize. That is, I feel the agony of another. Or that I hope that when I'm in dire need, I will be helped in the same way.
Host, this principle is what lies beneath the whole concept of social welfare. People realized that if there was no mutual assistance, they'd all suffer. That is, they would themselves suffer when they become the needy ones. Egoism forces man to give, but it's not true giving. It's simply man assuring himself of his future.
Guest, I think this kind of giving is not even something we should take into account. All our generosity is nothing more than a camouflaged reception, the satisfaction of oneself and one's dear ones.
Host,
so how can I give you pleasure that is more than the pleasure found in the food?
Guest,
that is not up to you, but to me. If the person coming to my house were not a common person but a very important personality, I would receive greater pleasure in giving to him than to an ordinary person. That means that your pleasure depends not on the food, but on who has prepared it for you.
Host,
so what can I do to make you respect me more?
Guest,
because I receive not for my benefit but for yours, that is, I give to you, the more respect I have for you, the more pleasure I will get knowing who it is I'm giving to.
Host,
so how can I deepen your esteem for me?
Guest,
tell me about yourself. Show me who you are. Then I could get pleasure not merely by receiving the food, but also knowing who is giving it to me.
knowing with whom I have a relationship. The smallest portion of food received from a great figure will be worth a much larger amount of pleasure. The pleasure grows in proportion to how great I consider you to be.
Host, that means that for the pleasure to become great, I must open myself up to you and must develop a likeness of me in you.
Guest, exactly. That's what creates a new hunger in me. The desire to give to you grows in proportion to your greatness, and not because I want to escape the sensation of shame, because the shame won't let me satisfy my hunger.
Host,
That way you begin to sense not the hunger, but my greatness and desire to render me pleasure. So in this, you start to fulfill not the appetite. It's not what brought you to me, but my greatness. It's not what brought you to me, but my greatness and the desire to please me.
Guest,
and what's wrong with that? I can receive pleasure from the food many times more than the food itself can actually give, because I add to the hunger a second desire, a will to bestow to you.
Host, that too I must fulfill.
Guest, no, that will end its fulfillment. I create myself. For that I need only to know you. Reveal yourself to me, and I will create within me a craving to bestow to you, and I will receive pleasure from the giving and not from the elimination of shame.
Host,
what will you gain from it, aside from the fact that your pleasure will increase?
Guest, clearly hinting that that's the point of it all.
There's another major profit. If I create in me a new will apart from the inherent hunger, I become the master of that will. I can always increase it, always fill it with pleasure, and always bestow to you by receiving pleasure.
Host,
doesn't its filling up, just as the hunger, lose that will?
Guest,
no, because I can always create within me a greater impression of you. New wills to bestow to you will constantly arise, and by receiving from you, I will carry out these wills. That process can go on indefinitely.
Host, and what does it depend on?
Guest, on constantly discovering new virtues and your greatness.
Host,
that means that for constant self-indulgence, so that even by receiving selfish pleasure, the hunger will not cease, but rather increase by that reception. A creation of a new hunger must be formed, the will to feel the giver.
Guest, yes, in addition to receiving the pleasure, the delicacies, a sense of the giver's greatness is developed.
The discovery of the host and the delicacies become the same. That the pleasure itself creates an awareness of the giver, that the giver, the food, and the attributes of the giver are all one and the same.
Host,
it turns out that at first, what you subconsciously wanted was the revelation of the giver. For you, this is in fact a filling up and nothing else.
Guest, in the beginning, I didn't even understand that this was what I wanted. I only saw the food and I thought that's what I wanted.
Host,
I did it on purpose.
So that gradually you would develop your own independent will, that you would supposedly create yourself, so that you would fill it by yourself. That means that you were taking the place of both guest and host simultaneously.
Guest, why is it all built like that?
Host, for the purpose of bringing you completeness, so that you will want each thing in totality and will attain maximum fulfillment. So that you'll enjoy each will, and so that the pleasure would be bound by nothing.
Guest,
so why didn't I know about it to begin with? After all I saw around me were objects I desired without suspecting that what I really wanted all this time was you.
Host,
it's specifically done so that from a situation in which you weren't feeling me, you'd by yourself come to me and would create that inner will on your own.
Guest,
but if I create that will within me, where are you in the picture?
Host,
it is I who created the simple egotistical will in you to begin with. I develop it by constantly surrounding you with new objects of delight.
Guest, but what is it all for?
Host, for the purpose of convincing you that no chasing of any pleasure will satisfy you.
Guest, I can see that.
The minute I get what I want, the pleasure I get is instantly gone, and again I long for something, either bigger or altogether different. I'm in a constant pleasure hunt, but I never quite attain it, because the minute I get my hands on it, it slips away.
Host, precisely for that reason you develop your sense of self and attain the awareness of the futility of this type of existence.
Guest, but by the time you develop in me the picture of what's happening, I would understand the meaning, the purpose of all that's taking place.
Host,
That picture is revealed only once you're totally convinced of the purposelessness of your egotistical existence. You become aware that a new form of conduct is required. You need to know your root and the meaning of your life. Guest, but that process lasts thousands of years. When does it end? Host, nothing is created needlessly. All that exists is there for the sole purpose of bringing creation to knowing a different form of existence. That process is slow because every single desire should spring up and be recognized as unworthy of use in its preliminary form. Guest, and are there many such desires? Host, a great many, in direct proportion to the pleasure you will receive in the future. But the pleasure from receiving the food doesn't change. You can't eat more than one lunch a day. The volume of your stomach will not change. Therefore, the amount that comes from me and is received by you doesn't change. But by dining at my table in order to please me, that very thought creates in you a new will and a new pleasure, apart from the pleasure of the food. That pleasure is measured in size and power, that is, quantity and quality, according to the amount of pleasure you get from dining at my table in order to please me. Guest, so how do I increase my desire to receive pleasure for your sake? Host, that depends on your appreciation and respect for me, on how great you consider me to be. Guest, so how can I increase my appreciation of you? Host, for that you simply need to know more about me, to see me in every action that I take, to observe and to be convinced how great I really am, convinced that I am almighty, merciful, and kind. Guest, then show yourself. Host, if your request stems from a desire to bestow to me, I will reveal myself. But if it stems from a desire to please yourself by seeing me, I will not only refrain from disclosing myself to you, but I will hide myself even deeper. Guest, why? Is it not the same for you whichever way I receive from you? After all, you want me to enjoy. Why hide from me? Host, if I disclose myself entirely to you, you will receive so much pleasure at the eternity, almightiness, and wholeness of me that you will not be able to accept that pleasure for my sake. That thought will not even cross your mind, and you will later feel ashamed again. Besides, because the pleasure will be perpetual, it will, as we've seen before, eliminate your want, and again you'll be left drained of will. Guest, so, that's the reason that you hide from me in order to help me. And I, for some reason, thought that it was because you didn't want me to know you. Host, my greatest wish is that you'll see me and be near to me. But what can I do if then you will not be able to sense pleasure? Wouldn't that be the same to you as dying? Guest, but if I'm unaware of you, then how can I make any progress? It all depends on how much you show yourself to me. Host, indeed, only the feeling of my presence creates in you the ability to grow and receive. Without that sense, you just swallow everything up and immediately stop sensing any pleasure. That's why when I appear before you, you feel shame, the sensation of the giver, a will to receive the same attributes as the giver. Guest, so reveal yourself to me as soon as possible. Host, I will, but only to the extent that you will benefit from it, although I'd always like to show myself to you. After all, I hid myself on purpose so as to create conditions of free choice for you to act and to choose how to think independently of my presence, and so there wouldn't be any pressure on the part of the host. Guest, so how do you reveal yourself to me? Host, I do it slowly and gradually. Each degree of disclosure is called a world, from the most hidden degree to the most exposed. The end. From here, it follows that a person's main objective is to elevate the importance of the Creator in his own eyes, i.e. to acquire faith in his greatness and might, since this is his only possibility to escape from the prison of personal egoism and into the higher worlds. As mentioned earlier, a person experiences extreme difficulty when he decides to follow the path of faith and to abandon all concerns for the self. The resulting feeling is one of isolation from the world. He is suspended in nothingness without the support of common sense, reason, or prior experience to support him. It is also as if he abandoned his own environment, family, and friends for the sake of being united with the Creator. The reason for such a sensation is a lack of faith in the Creator, i.e. a lack of sensing the Creator, his presence and his rule over all creation. One feels an absence of the object of faith. However, once an individual begins to sense the Creator's presence, he is ready to submit himself fully to his power and to follow the Creator blindly, always prepared to nullify himself completely to him, disparaging his intellect almost instinctively. For this reason, the most important problem confronting a person is how to perceive the presence of the Creator. Therefore, it's worthwhile to dedicate all your energy and all your thoughts for the sake of the Creator. Immediately, when such a feeling emerges, the person aspires with all his soul to cling to the Creator. This feeling about the Creator is called faith. The process can be accelerated if he considers this aim important. The more important it is to him, the faster he can achieve faith, i.e. the perception of the Creator. Therefore, the more important he views the perception of the Creator, the stronger the perception will be until it becomes ever-present in him. Luck, mazel in Hebrew, is a special manner of providence that a person can in no way influence. But it's dictated from above that a person has the responsibility to attempt to change his own nature. Afterwards, the Creator evaluates the efforts exerted by a person in this direction and eventually alters the person's nature as well as elevates him above our world. Prior to the time that a person makes any effort, he should not rely on the upper forces, luck, or on some other special treatment from above in the hope he will intervene on his behalf. Rather, he must begin with a full recognition that if he alone does not take action, he will not arrive at what he desires. However, once he completes some task, or engages in study, or exerts any other effort, he should reach this conclusion. Everything that he has achieved as a result of his efforts would have come about anyway even without exerting any effort, since the result has been predetermined by the Creator. Thus, the individual who yearns to comprehend true providence must early on try in all aspects of his life to combine in himself these contradictions. For instance, in the morning, one should start one's daily routine of study and work, leaving behind all thoughts of the Creator's divine rule over the world and over its inhabitants. Each person must work as if the final result depended only on him. But at the end of the day, under no circumstances whatsoever should he allow himself to imagine that what he has achieved is the result of his own effort. He must realize that even if he stayed in bed all day, he would still have arrived at the same result because that result has been predetermined by the Creator. Therefore, a person who wants to strive to live a life of truth must, on one hand, obey the laws of society and of nature just like everyone else, but on the other hand, must also believe in the Creator's absolute rule over the world. All of our deeds can be divided into either good, neutral, or evil. A person's task is to elevate his neutral deeds to the level of the good ones by combining, in his mind, the performance of the deeds with the awareness of the Creator's absolute rule. For example, a sick person, while quite aware of the fact that his cure is completely in the hands of the Creator, should take the medication prescribed by an established physician and must believe that the doctor's skill will help him overcome his ailment. But having taken the medication in strict accordance with the doctor's orders and recovered, he must believe that he would have recovered anyway because it was the Creator's plan that he be healed. Therefore, instead of thanking the doctor, he must thank the Creator. In this way, a person converts a neutral act into a spiritual one. By repeating this process in regard to all his neutral acts, the person gradually spiritualizes all of his thoughts. The examples and explanations given above are issues because, as mentioned, they may become serious stumbling blocks on a person's way to spiritual elevation. The problem sometimes becomes greater because he thinks he understands the principles of divine rule. He will concentrate his energies artificially on strengthening his belief in the omnipresence of the Creator instead of working hard on himself. Often, in order to demonstrate faith in the Creator or simply out of laziness, one assumes even before starting work on oneself that all is in the Creator's power. One's efforts are not needed. Moreover, one shuts one's eyes and relies on blind faith alone. One eludes vital questions without real faith. By avoiding answering these questions, these individuals rob themselves of the possibility to progress spiritually. It is said of our world, "Thou shalt earn thy bread by the sweat of thy brow." However, once a person has earned something, it's hard for him to admit that the result did not depend on his hard work or on his abilities. Rather, it was the Creator who has done it all. He must strive by the sweat of his brow to strengthen his faith in the Creator's absolute rule. But it is in the attempts and endeavors to understand the contradictory nature of divine rule, which seems contradictory because of our blindness, and from the clash between these contradictory and perplexing strategies of what exactly is required of us, we will grow and experience new spiritual sensations.